September 2001. I had just started my doctoral studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. About a week into the semester, as I was exiting the F-stop on Houston Street and 2nd Avenue, I was nearly hit by a minivan with sirens blaring, speeding downtown. I stopped at the corner, cursing the driver. When I looked up, I saw dark smoke rising from Lower Manhattan. "What building is that coming from?" I asked the person next to me. "That's the Trade Center," he said.
Yeah. This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center.
Apparently, a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center in New York.
Moments later, with a flash and boom, the second tower exploded. I stood on the corner for what felt like hours or days, reluctant to leave the small group of people who had formed. Until a wild-eyed man covered in ash, a grim messenger, made his way toward us. He said he'd seen people flinging themselves from the burning buildings. "They were falling to the ground in flames," he said. I thought he was delusional. But I knew something had gone wrong. Very wrong. That day, I entered a different sort of world from the one that I had been living in, or imagined that I was living in. A world that is more unstable and uncertain. A world where skyscrapers explode before one's eyes on the most perfect and mild of September days. I know many people live with unrelenting, painful insecurity. But for someone like me, who had grown up in the New York City suburbs in the 1980s, on September 11th, I was forced to reckon with a reality that was new to me. The idea of what was possible in the world changed. What daily life could be transformed. I was flooded, deluged with a different kind of reality. I was swamped. I'm Joshua Moses, and this is my new podcast, Swamped: What Experts Do When They No Longer Know What to Do. For more than 20 years, I've been preoccupied with how humans respond to extreme events and the kinds of resources that we draw on when our worlds explode and become unrecognizable. I explore this in my book, Anxious Experts, and my work as a professor at Haverford College. Since I watched the towers come down, witnessed the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and the impact of warming temperatures in the Arctic, I have wanted to understand how other people learn from these experiences. What do they do? Who do they turn to? How do they rebound? What wisdom and ballast do they find, if any, in moments when they feel like they are drowning? Do they pray, call their best friend, become paralyzed, break down crying, leave their jobs, go back to school, learn new skills, find a new home, start meditating, find God or lose God? In short, what do people do when they no longer know what to do? In this episode, you'll hear the stories of three people who found themselves in over their heads. Joe Bruno, former commissioner of the NYC Office of Emergency Management. He was in charge when Hurricane Sandy hit. Ed Shevlin, a sanitation worker tasked with helping clean up after Sandy. And poet Marie Howe, who discovered a group of everyday superheroes she calls the Bridge Guys.
My name is Marie Howe. I live in New York City, and I have a daughter. I'm a writer. I write books of poems, and I have been teaching poetry in college and graduate school for a very long time now. I teach primarily at Sarah Lawrence College, but I also teach workshops around the world. And poetry, for me, is the human song.
This is my friend, the poet Marie Howe. I wanted to introduce you to Marie because she told me a story years ago that has just stuck in my head. I kept thinking about it. Did it really happen, or was it part of some kind of poetic fantasy?
I grew up with a lot of fear. You know, it's many of us have fears and phobias. But for me, they were concentrated for a while on tunnels and bridges. And I found it difficult to drive over bridges. And I became a mother after 50 when I adopted my daughter from China. I was just divorced and I adopted her. And I had this little girl in the back seat. And suddenly I really couldn't avoid bridges anymore in the same way. There were places we had to go. And sometimes it worked out okay. And other times it really didn't. And I would have these panic attacks. And one time we were driving from New York, from Manhattan, upstate somewhere. And in order to do so, we had to cross the Tappan Zee Bridge.
At the time, the Tappan Zee was a narrow bridge that crossed the Hudson River. It was 3 miles long.
So I thought, I'm going to do this. I was with one of my dear friends, Donna, who does not drive. This is a key issue in the story. And she was in the front seat, and my daughter, Inan, was in the back seat in a booster seat. She was a toddler. And I had a cup of latte, and I was driving, and I was okay. And we started to cross the bridge, and the panic attack came on. I thought, I will die if I continue on this bridge. It wasn't even falling. It was a sense of being trapped in between things with no way out. I slowed the car down, and Donna said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I can't go on." And I just stopped. And she said, "I'm having a panic attack." Now, it looked like I was very calm, but inside I was, having a full-blown, "I'm going to die any minute" panic attack. And she said, "You can't stop." And I said, "I am stopping. Everyone's beeping. They're going around me. And I said, "Maybe if we sang." And I turned back to Inan and I said, "Should we sing?" At which point Donna began loudly belting out "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star." And I said, no, that's not going to help. Donna was wildly nervous about all this, but I really couldn't figure out how we were going to get across the bridge. And the panic attack was just mounting, getting worse and worse. And all of a sudden, this huge vehicle came behind me, huge vehicle. It seemed like 2 stories tall with huge lights. And she's like, "What's that?" I said, "I don't know." And the guy came and knocked on my window and I rolled it down. He said, "Are you having trouble?" I said, "Yes, I'm having a panic attack."
Marie's experience resonated with me. I remember similar panic moments from my life. And I wondered if this feeling of being trapped on a bridge, no way forward and no way back, was something others could relate to. If it captured a feeling of uncertainty, of not knowing what to do next, that many of us have experienced. But then sometimes, all of a sudden...
And he said, "Would you like me to drive you across the bridge?" And I said, "Yeah, who are you?" And he said, "We're the bridge guys." And I said, "The bridge guys?" And he said, "Yeah, hold on a second. Joe, I'm driving her over." And he said, "Can you move over?" I said, "Yeah." I jumped on over the, there was the thing in the middle there, the gear shift, onto Donna's lap. I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "We're the bridge guys." And I said, "You're an angel." He said, "No, this is what we do. We drive back and forth across the bridge and we help people if they have breakdown or if they get scared." He said, "You'd be surprised how many people." I said, "I'm so ashamed." He said, no, never be ashamed. He said, "Marie," because by that time he knew my name, "we have CEOs of large companies who pull over before the bridge and we drive them across every day. There are a lot of people who are phobic about bridges." And I felt like I had just been carried across the void by this guy. And we went across the bridge, all fears gone. And he pulled over and he said, "Bye-bye. Remember, just pull over whenever you need to. Both sides, there's this place where you can do that." And I said, "You've changed my life. Thank you so much. And bye-bye." And we went on our way. And that changed the way I felt about the Tappan Zee Bridge from there on in, And now I know or believe there's always a bridge guy.
Joe Bruno, former commissioner of the New York City Office of Emergency Management. I was the fire commissioner in New York City as well. I had about 45 years in government, most of it in city government, in the law department, fire department, Office of Emergency Management, and also I was a judge for 13 years, a Supreme Court judge and a civil court judge before that.
I first met Joe around 2006. I was conducting research on disaster response in New York City. He made an enduring impression on me. In my memory, Bruno was a prophetic, blunt truth teller who helped me to see reality in a new way. He projected a kind of old-school, salt-of-the-earth, Brooklyn feeling that was instantly reassuring. Still rattled by the attacks of 2001, we were constantly being warned about dirty bomb threats in New York City. Riding the subway had become an exercise in fear management, and more than one person I knew made sure to have a few Ativans stashed in their bags just in case. In our recent conversation, I kicked off by asking Joe, how did he prepare himself mentally each day when he was commissioner of the Office of Emergency Management? What was it like being responsible for New York City during some of the most threatening disasters in history?
Well, I wish I did all this myself, but I had, for one, what I did was I went from a 50-person agency to a 200-person agency. And I hired some of the best people around the country to come work because they all wanted to come to New York. We game played in the emergencies we set out as we might have. For example, we were always concerned after September 11 with a terrorist attack, or be it biological, radiological, or just a straight old attack. We did a lot of planning around terrorism, bio and radiological, let's call it.
So you were responsible in some ways for the health and safety of, what, 8 million people?
Eight plus 2 million that come in every day, or did come in.
You know, I have one kid, and I have a classroom sometimes of 30 students that I'm responsible for an hour or so, which stresses me out a little bit some days. But you had this whole city to be responsible for. So you'd wake up in the morning and, you know, think about what lay ahead for you for a day. Did it weigh on you, that sense of responsibility? And if it did, were there things that you did that helped you deal with that kind of level of responsibility that very few of us ever have in our lives?
I always worry about something really bad happening, you know, explosion, a radiological incident where we got shut down parts of the city. But I always felt that we could handle it because, one, we've handled everything else.
There were some moments in our conversation when Bruno admitted to the worries that if I were in his position, would have kept me up all night, every night.
So, yes, I did worry, but I knew we were doing the right thing. But the unexpected, I don't know what I would have done if we ever had a nuclear event. Pretty scary, but I certainly wouldn't have gone anywhere else other than to OEM and taking care of it along with my guys who were there, my people.
Joe spoke matter-of-factly about deeply terrifying possibilities. When I brought up our conversation from 2006, when he said he worried more about massive flooding in New York City than a dirty bomb, he replied,
"A dirty bomb is scary, but generally localized. A nuclear incident that has fallout is a totally different thing, right? That's why I said that about a dirty bomb. But floods, we're always concerned about it."
Though Joe described the events of Hurricane Sandy with characteristic coolness and rationality, he was clearly unsettled and taken by surprise.
When Sandy hit us in 2012, their view of that storm was different than what happened. Their view of that storm was that it was a big storm, but it was essentially a Category 1, not a lot of rain, and that it would not impact New York City that greatly. It changed course a bit. The water, the surge, was coming in to New York City and, of course, New Jersey and all the rest that got hit way out to Long Island. The one thing they didn't take account of is the size of the storm. When the National Weather Service planned, they planned on the max being 45 miles radius. Sandy was 115 miles radius, so 230 miles across. They had never planned for that. We realized when we finished up on this whole thing that we needed to start planning ourselves. And we couldn't rely on the National Weather Service for that. So we had 5 foot of water almost coming over the top and flooding all of lower Manhattan. That knocked out all of the telephone service of Verizon. It ended it. So, you know, this is a massive flooding. We flooded out hospitals in Coney Island, a mile from the coast, flooded out. So this was something much bigger.
Sometimes the models blow up and the predictions are wrong. Sometimes, despite having the best team in the world, the best science, the most extensive training. We are overwhelmed.
They said to us, now model has to our model has to change. This is twice the size of what we are looking at, two and a half times the size of what we are predicting. So now we got to predict something else. They did, less than 12 hours before, they said, you better be doing X, Y, Z evacuations right now. And we did.
What was it like during Sandy watching the whole storm situation unfold? Yeah. That must have been quite a time.
Well, we have a great photo that I use in probably 100 presentations of the Rockaways and the storm hitting it and a man standing there watching it and this water coming right over him. Pretty wild.
The world can surprise us even with the best plans. Even if you're someone like Joe Bruno, who has decades of experience responding to emergencies in New York City. Joe told me that Hurricane Sandy scared the hell out of him.
You plan a lot, but planning isn't everything. You know, you have to sometimes look behind it. Overall, we still think we have a good model to handle emergencies.
The coastline was swamped, the city was swamped, government agencies were swamped, and I wondered if Bruno also felt swamped. This was the one time during our conversation that Bruno became obviously emotional, talking about how people acted in support of city workers after 9/11.
At 9/11, we saw the public come out and support fire and PD. I got a little emotional about that. I don't know why. But yes, during snowstorms and during emergencies, the public is very good.
Bruno had been the head of the fire department and part of NYC emergency response for decades. I can only imagine that he was thinking of the many responders who died on September 11th, 2001.
So we touched on this before, moments where you might have felt swamped or overwhelmed by challenges you were facing. Were there any people that you turned to for help or advice consistently in any times, whether it's a good friend, somebody in the profession, somebody outside the profession?
There's no magic person I call. I didn't call my friend Greg in, Westchester, say, hey, Greg, I'm really screwed up here.
I was hoping to hear about who Bruno relied on when he felt like he was in over his head. I imagined him calling a wise and trusted friend, someone who seemingly always knows what to do. Maybe that's because that's what I would hope for when I put myself in his position on the day when Sandy hit. I would have wanted to call someone and say, hey, there's an unbelievably massive hurricane threatening to wash New York City away. What should I do?
I went to people who had influence and could calm the waters a bit. I wasn't calm during this thing. I was, you know, over the top at certain times and sometimes even do things and say things you shouldn't. But in the end, everything did calm down. I didn't allow him to see me not calm.
You're able to, as they say, fake it till you make it. Yeah. I guess that's part of the job, huh, is projecting calmness and coolness for the most part.
Yeah. Confidence. That I was confident we could handle it. In every emergency, that's what we do.
Joe showed a deep care for his mission as a public servant and a belief in himself. His pride in his hometown of New York City was clear.
Why am I doing this? Because I get paid? Yeah. To some extent. I'm doing it because I'm doing really good stuff. That's why I'm proud of myself. That's why I'm proud to be a part of it. That all translates back to a good place to be, a good agency to work in, a good place to spend a lot of your life in. I mean, I've spent 45 years in government. It's more than half my life. And so I believe that what Ed Koch said to me, Mayor Koch, said public service is the noblest of professions if done well and done honestly.
I left the conversation wanting to be a better citizen, to do more, be a better person. In his humble, confident way, Joe provides an example of a model public servant, someone who steadfastly steered his city through the worst imaginable disasters, who learned from experience. Someone who can be relied upon even when swamped. Someone who knows what to do even when overwhelmed, when they might not actually know what to do. I wanted to hear from someone who was involved with the Sandy response after the floodwaters had subsided. Someone who saw a very different side of the city. I came across an article about a guy named Ed Shevlin while looking for Sandy first responders to interview. Ed was hired to the NYC Sanitation Department during the Dinkins administration in 1993. He'd seen NYC at its worst in his 22 years, riding the garbage truck through the city. He'd been shot at by drug dealers and even came across several dead bodies.
I got stabbed with a hypodermic needle. I got bitten by a possum. I got bitten by a Rottweiler. I got hit by a car. It was just my hand when the car mounted the sidewalk and raced around the garbage truck. It was a Saturday morning in East New York, and he had to go. And I was on my way back to the truck with the bag, and as he flew by, his mirror hit my hand.
Before speaking with Ed, I hadn't thought much about what sanitation workers face after a major disaster. His experience offered an entirely different view on being swamped. Bruno had the big picture of how New York City agencies respond to disasters. Ed was on the ground in his neighborhood.
You just have to be a good neighbor and be willing to help the people around you.
I asked Ed where he was the day Hurricane Sandy landed.
Thanks to our meteorologists, we all knew what was coming. You know, it was 500 miles across, and it was going to hit the whole coast, the whole Northeast all at once. You know, well, the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast region anyway.
According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, at its maximum, Hurricane Sandy stretched nearly 1,000 miles wide.
And I lived in Rockaway Beach at the time on Shorefront Parkway in an apartment building. And all the windows in my one-bedroom apartment faced the Atlantic Ocean. I could see the storm building. Like the day before, I'm a former surfer. And I have a good eye for watching the waves. And when storms are far away, you can tell that they're coming because the surf picks up. And from my balcony, I was watching the day before as everything started building. And at the Department of Sanitation, we wanted to protect our equipment because we knew that we were going into this immediately when the storm ended. But who knew? You know, we were told this is what's going to happen, and it was prudent to move the equipment off the peninsula. But, you know, I stayed. A lot of people evacuated, but I knew that I would be part of the response, and I was on the third floor of the building. I knew that the electricity would go out.
Though Sandy took him by surprise, Ed was more prepared than most New Yorkers. He was an experienced camper with lots of gear.
I had a survival radio. I had a propane lantern with a few spare bottles of propane. And I just stayed up, and the storm started hitting us that night. And I went out on the terrace periodically to see just how bad it was. And it was pretty bad.
It sounds like you had more awareness of what was coming than most people. Because like you said, you were a surfer, you were watching the ocean, you live right there. But even with that, would you say what you saw took you off guard?
Yeah, it was an eye-opener. Like, of course, you know, things are going to get flooded, but you don't think that the floods are going to cause short circuits and they're going to cause electrical fires. Because I never heard of any of that when I spoke to people who lived through Hurricane Donna, which was the last storm that inundated the whole peninsula, you know, that went across from ocean to bay. So I was completely unprepared for what I saw.
So the scale of the cleanup must have been just tremendous from a sanitation worker's point of view. I can just imagine, you know, a normal day in New York, there's a lot of work to be done. But this is like you said, it's biblical.
Yeah, it was totally out of proportion to anything that we had been doing. For example, the target weight for a collection truck, that's a garbage truck picking up regular garbage in the city of New York at that time was 10.7 tons per day. So that would be like the average weight that two men on a truck would pick up. And that's significant. That 10.7 tons, if picked up in one section, so that's the Rockaway Park through Bell Harbor and the ponds, that area, that would probably take you 200 houses, right, to pick up 10.7 tons. That's a guesstimate. I'm not sure. But two of my buddies got 14 and a half tons from two houses. Now, Rockaway is basically a sandbar.
A sandbar. For me, that conjures up an image of a vulnerable strip that could easily slide into the sea. One of the things that surprised me about Ed's work was how emotional it was. I hadn't thought about the day-to-day experience of hauling away people's cherished belongings that had been transformed into trash, and the toll that might take on sanitation workers. I could feel Ed's heart breaking for his neighbors.
When we went to a house and we were loading a truck, you try and do it as fast as you could, because oft times the homeowner was on the front porch crying, you know, looking at their lives being dragged away in a garbage truck. And no one expects that. But, you know, they're our friends and neighbors, and everyone tried to be considerate of that. But you would get, you know, 7 tons from one house and just go next door and get another 7 tons. And that repeated throughout the whole recovery. And one thing that I noticed that I commented on before was that when everyone's gone, when the Army's gone, when the Navy's gone, the Marines are gone, and all the other agencies, when the Mormons go home, the Department of Sanitation is still going to be here for years.
That seems like a really important point to me. And it goes back to something you said earlier about how sanitation workers aren't often seen or given the credit for being responders, but they're there on the front line, and then they're there long after the event is over, and they see the day-to-day recovery, the emotional aspects, the physical aspects.
Yeah. And think of it this way too, with police and fire departments. Hopefully, they're never coming to your house to help you, because that means something bad has happened. But sanitation workers are at people's homes twice a week, all over the whole city. We see them all the time. They speak to us about all kinds of different things. We make friends with them, and we know who they are. It's important.
It's an important view onto the city. And also what you're saying, I think, is particularly after a hurricane like that, it's not just trash people are getting rid of. It's the things, their loved objects, the things that are important to them, their lives.
Yeah, it's computers and TVs, and it's photo albums that are ruined. It's the dining room table that's been ruined. And gee, it wasn't trash before the storm, but it was transformed into trash by the storm. And then it had to go. And it was very emotional for me. It was a unique perspective, and maybe a little more so for me because I lived in the neighborhood. I used to pick up my kindergarten teacher's garbage. I picked up friends' garbage every day. I mean, I knew everyone. When we got our morning break and we went to the shops on 129th Street, I knew the guy who was making my egg sandwich, and people would come up and say, "Hey, when you guys stop by the house, I'm going to have some big stuff outside. Is that okay?"
Was there a moment where you felt particularly overwhelmed or swamped, where you're like, "Oh my goodness, this is more than I can handle"?
No.
Like Bruno, Ed's commitment to his city, to his community, his religious faith kept him going. When the floods came, when things exploded, Ed wasn't going to be stopped. This was not a normal day or a normal week or normal months, or in some ways even normal years, from what you're saying. Years later, they were still dealing with some of the detritus from the hurricane. What did you learn? And are there things that you learned that you would share with other people, younger folks or people in similar situations?
I learned a lot of things, and I think that maybe the most important takeaway is that people are good. In times of disaster, think about 9/11 and how polite people were to each other following 9/11. They were giving up their seat on the train. They were holding a door for a stranger. They were buying a meal for a homeless person, right? But I learned that the neighborhood where I'm from is resilient and loving and full of people who are willing to help each other. And when you pull together, you can overcome almost any hardship, any incident. But it takes teamwork.
That's a beautiful thing to learn.
Yeah, it was a good takeaway.
The world can be a scary place. Sometimes it's daily life, like driving over a bridge that gets you. Sometimes it's waking up to a massive hurricane and being responsible for the lives of 8.5 million people. Or transporting the loved possessions of your neighbors by the ton to be thrown away. There are times we get help from others in unexpected ways. In Marie's case, something amazing happened. I think something that many of us wish would happen in our own lives when we feel swamped. I certainly do. Whenever you tell that story, I get this, like, just a good feeling.
Yeah.
Whenever the bridge guys come in, that's one of the things that stuck with me about
the bridge
it.
Guys.
Yeah, because I think about it sometimes in my own life, and I'm like, if only the bridge guys would show up right now.
And you also want to be a bridge guy.
Yes, that too.
That's the big thing. I always stop when I see a car.
Yes.
And I roll down my window and I say, can I help you? Is there something? You know, because it's like, you want to be a bridge guy, wherever you are, you know, and that or on the sidewalk. I feel like we need bridge guys. And there's so many homeless people in New York now. And so many of them are curled up and look dead. And there was a woman the other day at a cafe, completely splayed over the table, absolutely inert. And I thought, bridge guy. And I just, it's intrusive, but I just say, excuse me, ma'am, are you all right? Didn't move. And she finally looked up and said, yes, I'm all right. I said, okay, thanks, just checking. And I began to walk away and she said, miss. And I turned around, I said, yes. She said, thank you. And I thought, this is what we have to be for each other. Really, it sounds so corny, but it's true.
I think we want to believe this, particularly these days when things often feel too much. We want to believe that there's someone out there to take us across, to hold our hand, to make sure we are safe, to help us feel better about a world that often feels unpredictable and frightening. Maybe we wish for a powerful parent-like superhero when the bridge feels endless and like it's sinking into the sea. But often this person doesn't arrive. Sometimes the waters seem too high, the storm too big, and the heaps of debris and rubble insurmountable.
And it takes an awful lot of courage to feel hope. It's much easier to be cynical. You're armored. So I think that is a great gift to keep giving ourselves as well.
Sometimes a friend, or an imagined better future, or religious beliefs keep us going when we feel there's no way forward. For Marie, it was her child.
Part of being a mother is you don't want to tell your child when they're too young that you're afraid. So also becoming a mother helped me a lot, because even though both these stories have her in it, eventually you just get braver, because you have to be brave.
Ed's view of his job echoed Marie's story of the bridge guys. He saw himself as the human face of the New York City bureaucracy, someone helping to guide people through the darkest days of their lives. He was not there only to haul away trash, but to witness people's lives and to help them grieve in the face of immense loss. It was clear that Marie's story resonated.
They were shepherds.
Exactly.
You know, they protect the flock. And you can draw any kind of analogy out of that you want. You know, you look at the Good Shepherd, Jesus, you know, it's just, it's endless. It's the story of humanity. Humans help each other.
Joe Bruno also said something similar about most people being good.
The people of see New York are not bad people in any way. They're good people. They're like everywhere. They're like small towns, because every neighborhood's like a little small town.
There's a lot that's terrifying about living in this world. The pandemic, unending gun deaths, racialized violence, authoritarianism, government instability, climate migration. Sometimes it all feels insurmountable. I think Marie's story about the bridge guys appeals to me so much because it offers a myth in the best sense, a fairy tale, a possibility, a dream that someone might come to rescue us. Though in her case, the dream was real. I know it's more complicated than that. There's no one to rescue us. There's no easy solution in any obvious, clear, simple sense of the word. But from very different viewpoints and life experiences, Marie, Joe, and Ed came to a similar conclusion. When they felt swamped, they came to the simple realization that people are good. And maybe that's what the Bridge Guys story is about. Not those bridge guys, but like Joe and Ed, most people, most of us, when we don't know what to do, can be that for each other. Bridge guys. Maybe the bridge story is a bridge in itself, an imaginative link to help get us from here to there, a place that we have yet to dream up. I'm still not sure if this is true, but for now, I'm sticking to it and hoping when the outcome feels uncertain, and we no longer know what to do, it gets me and you to the other side of a bridge. This pilot episode of Swamped was written and hosted by me, Joshua Moses. It was produced and edited by Alex Lewis and John Myers of Row Home Productions. It was funded by Haverford College's Visual Culture, Arts, and Media Community Media Grant. Thank you to Laura McGrain, James Weisinger, and Charles Crawford for making this project possible. Thank you to Teddy Gross for coming up with the name. And thank you to Amber Huntley and Talia Mae Moses for listening to many, many versions. Finally, this work is dedicated to all humans who find themselves in over their heads or swamped.